All right, so we're going to begin in just a couple of seconds. All right, it's 8:15. I think it's time to begin. All right, so I'm very excited about tonight. Not sure about all of you. So just a little bit of a confession. So generally speaking, my father and I, we usually discuss the questions, at least in a general sense, before we do these things, as we've been doing the past couple of weeks. This week, however, we actually haven't. This is entirely spontaneous, at least from my father's point of view. I know what I'm going to ask him. He has no idea. This is going to be a personal discussion, which I hope has relevance to everybody, because it's not just going to be personal. Obviously, we're going to try and examine lessons for every single one of us. But the idea here is to get into a little bit of a personal discussion with my father, Rabbi Gerari, about his life, particularly focusing on his religious life, his upbringing, why he is the way he is today, has he ever doubted what he should become, etc., etc. So we'll get right into it. As we always say, let's try and make this a little bit interactive. If anybody has any of their own questions, feel free to post it on the chat, to private message me, to post it on Facebook if you're watching on Facebook, whatever the case is. So let's get right into it. Before we sort of get into details and then sort of more personal and more heavy questions, maybe you can just describe to everybody what type of upbringing you actually had. Religiously, what type of environment were you brought up in? We all know you were born in South Africa, but just explain to us a little bit what type of household you were brought up in.
Yes, first of all, good evening, everyone. Great to be here. As my son Levi mentioned, this is a little bit, normally I have some sort of idea. Today I have no idea what's coming. So it's, if I have to say so myself, courageous on my part. We're up for the challenge. So let's have some fun, hopefully. So just a bit of background. So I was born in Cape Town, grew up in Johannesburg. My mother was, may she be well and live long. She was born in White Russia, Poland, but came to South Africa when she was very, very young, before the war. Her father, the famous Rabbi Aloy from Johannesburg, was a rabbi, so she grew up in a rabbi's house. But very differently to my father. My father was born in Riga, grew up in Israel, grew up in a very, very strong Hasidic family, traveled in 1950 to the Lubavitcher Rebbe, as the Rebbe just became Rebbe. Spent five years there learning, studying next to him. And then someone put my mother and my father together. Quite different, very different upbringing, very different background, but a beautiful marriage. My father, of blessed memory, moved to South Africa with my mother. And I grew up in that household. Now, in terms of religious observance, my parents were both religious. My father was from a Chabad background. A very strong Chabad Hasid. My grandfather, Rabbi Eloy, not so known in South Africa, also came from a very strong Chabad background, but studied in non-Chabad yeshivas. So he was kind of
mixed character.
Quite mixed. At a very sort of, yeah, and it was his strength as well, part of his strength, but he sort of understood everyone kind of thing. So the background was Chabad, but there was no Chabad those days in South Africa. So my mother was much more part of Bnei Akiva at the time. Hoping she listens to this, doesn't get upset that I said that. But they were on the same page. And I grew up in a very, very strong, observant home. My father was a very great Torah scholar. Very tremendous emphasis on learning. But he himself was in business. He was not a rabbi. He was an ordained rabbi. And for a few years, he had a bash at being a rabbi. Completely hated it. It wasn't for him. And in fact, it wasn't his intended career altogether. upon the advice of the Lubavitch Rebbe, he was actually going into business, but originally couldn't get a visa to come to South Africa. Oresi was a practicing rabbi, so that's how he landed up as a rabbi. Wasn't for him at all. Didn't have the patience for it, didn't have lots of things that go with it, and went into business. And in fact, he went into business the same year I was born, and he was in business all his life. So it was a very, it was an incredible strength there, because it was an example of, my father wasn't paid to be religious. He was genuinely, observant, was very much in the business world, yet himself was deeply, deeply from and religious and observant. Tremendous emphasis. It was a house where he spoke a lot about learning, and there was a tremendous emphasis on Jewish learning. And yeah, in a nutshell, that's how I grew up.
Yeah, I'm just looking at, I mean, even though this is totally not the subject, but I'm just looking at the list of people that have joined us on Zoom. I'm sure many of them knew your grandfather, Rabbi Adler. Can you just maybe discuss, just for 30 seconds or so, your relationship with him?
So
Besides the fact he was your grandfather, I mean,
So I consider him one of the role models of my life in terms of what I'm doing, meaning I always think back about what he would do. We were very close. Part of why we were very close, it was not because he was a rabbi, it was despite the fact that he was a rabbi. In other words, I never realized until I grew up how busy he must have been. And yet when he came to our home, he always had time for his grandchildren. He was an amazing grandfather. So I knew him as a Zayda first and then a rabbi later. But as I grew older and observed him as a rabbi, I learned a lot from him directly, but just by observing him as well, hearing him tell stories, hearing him repeat things that he'd gone through. We spent a lot of time together in various different circumstances. And I still miss him, actually, and always think back to him. And often in rabbinic situations, often in my experiences, I often think back about what do I think he would do, very, very often.
Hmm. And just sort of another side point on what you mentioned, that you said that your parents had very different backgrounds from where they came from. Did that work? How did that work? What was your sort of impression growing up? Did they have different value systems? Did they have a united front?
No, completely united front. They were completely on the same page. I mean, I'm sure that when they first got married, it was a little bit of work to do, I imagine. But you have to understand that my mother came from a house also. My grandfather was very into learning, always wanted a son-in-law that would be a Torah scholar, did come from a very strong Chabad background. Just the environment in South Africa was very... When I say they were different, I mean they were different in their environments. South Africa at that time, Johannesburg at that time, was a very different environment. My mother went to a co-ed non-Jewish school. My father went to a very, very, very strong Hasidic boys-only cheder in Israel. I mean, it just was totally different.
Mm.
But it's what my mother always wanted. In essence, she was exactly the same as my father. In fact, just a little story. I know my mother won't mind me saying the story, that when they were going out, my father actually, who at that time the Rebbe was very accessible, it was the very early years of the Lubavitch Rebbe's leadership. My father went into him and he said, look, it looks very good. It's a great idea, this. But I'm a little worried. You know, a girl from South Africa went to a non-Jewish school and kind of, you know, I'm not sure it'll work. So the Rebbe assured him that my mother will be, he said in Yiddish, she'll be Spitz Chabad. What that means, in other words, she'll fit right into it. You don't have to, nothing to worry about.
Yeah.
That's exactly what happened.
And as someone who observed it, it came true. Let's get a little bit deeper for a moment. And I think this, you know, there are many different types of religious Jews. Some people are born religious. Some people are not. Some people sort of found it later in life. Obviously, you were born into a religious family from day one. It's your bread and butter. I was too, obviously. So maybe you can talk to that a little bit. Meaning, you were taught this from day one. You were never really given a choice. You can almost say you were brainwashed in a way. I mean, you know, why don't we? And I was also brought up, obviously, in a very religious household. We weren't taught other religions. We weren't taught other philosophies, other faiths. Is that a bad thing? Is that a good thing? Is that very closed-minded parenting? Not that I feel that it is, but maybe you can explain, sort of to people who are listening, why it isn't, sort of logically speaking. Why don't we expose our children to, like, you know, let them choose when they grow up. When they turn 18, let them make the choice.
So I'm happy you put that little piece at the end, because I was actually, my first response was going to be, do you feel brainwashed? So that's a very good question. So I don't know what other questions you got coming. So I'm just going to speak, and if I answer some of your future questions,
it's fine.
So be it. So I had a couple of comments, and do I have a few minutes for this answer?
You can go as long as you want.
Okay. So first of all, let's just talk about the brainwashing thing. I want to talk about two things. I want to talk about the brainwashing thing, and I want to talk about growing up in it. So you're like, do you have a choice kind of thing, right? So I don't actually subscribe to the brainwashing argument. I mean, I've been asked this before, right? Because the parents' role, I think, is a parenting thing, right? I think parents' role is to imbue their children with values, right? Fundamental values. Values are based on a philosophy. They're based on what you believe in. They're based on what you think is right, what you think is good, what you think is meaningful, what you think is purposeful, right? Most people will say that they try and educate their children to be very tolerant, let's say, right? Well, maybe not. Maybe you should expose them to intolerance. Now, I mean, that sounds silly, but no, because obviously I want my children to be kind. Everyone will agree that I want my children to be kind. I want my children to be generous, to be empathetic. I want them to be tolerant to others, accepting to, and so on and so forth, right? Now, we know there are some cultures where tolerance is not really that prevalent. So maybe we should teach them to be intolerant. No, but if you believe in something, you don't have a problem, for want of a better word, imposing that on your children, because that's parents' responsibility. Parents' responsibility is to pass on to their children what they believe in, right? Now, it needs to be done in a nurturing way. It needs to be done in a context of love, 100%. In other words, it's got to be done in a way where it should be never be fought. You shouldn't force any value on children, but you should want to imbue them and guide them in the way that you believe is the correct path, right? Now, in that, this is the mistake some parents make, in that even if you have fundamental values, different children will absorb it in different ways. And even if you're successful in imparting your values to all your children, they will all implement it in their own unique individualistic way, which is very, very important. The brainwashing is probably the incorrect word, but the brainwashing negative that you talk about is when parents not only impart values and not only teach values, but they want to create molds, right? They want to create clones of themselves, and that doesn't work. That never works, and that shouldn't work, because people are individuals, and that's really, really important. And people should be, and that's you know, we know this from the Mishkan. In the sanctuary, there was a menorah, and God said that the menorah had seven branches. And that seven branches, however, they had to be seven distinct branches, but they had to be made from one solid piece of gold, right? And we know that the Kabbalists talk about this idea, and they say, yeah, the seven branches represent seven different types of Jews, seven different types of parts, but they come from the same mold, they come from the same value. So that's where brainwashing isn't a good idea. In other words, it has to be, you are completely in charge. You are completely, not authority is the wrong word, but parents have a responsibility, put it that way, of guiding their children in a particular set of values. And if those values is faith in God and religious observance, that's 100% fine, but they need to, and not only is fine, it's good. In other words, you should be imparting that, right? However, you need to do it in such a way where you also allow for individual expression, for your different children to impart the exactly same values, the same menorah, the same candelabra, but perhaps in different branches and different ways, that doesn't compromise the values, but yet has individual expression, right? So I think that's part one. Now, I grew up in a home where I have to say, you said you want to be personal, so I'm sharing with you my personal journey, right? That my father, and I look at this as a very important role of parenting, because the values that you impart to your children, the first and foremost rule of imparting values successfully is that you have to live it and mean it, right? Mm. You actually can't really impart values if you don't believe in yourself, right? So you have to, and I grew up in a home where faith, for example, emunah, was not just taught, it was breathed, it was lived. To my father, it was a reality. There was no such thing, anything happens in life that doesn't come from God. The concept of Ashkacha Pratit, everything's about divine providence, the concept that you'll never lose out by doing something that God wants you to do, and and so on and so forth. I mean, I can tell you stories. I mean, just, you know, many, many stories of that, but it was just, it was real, it was sincere, which I think why it was successful. And it was very impactful, right? So I think that's part one. Part two of the discussion is this. You talked about choice, having choice, right? So I'm just gonna tell you a little thought that I think people will find useful and I'll apply to this, right? So, you know, when God gave the Torah, we are taught that when God gave the Torah, the Jewish people really weren't that ready, right? So what did God do? The Kabbalah tells us the Talmud says he held Mount Sinai over the Jewish people, right? He said, you better accept the Torah. And Kabbalah explains that it wasn't forcing him, actually. What he did was he overwhelmed them with love, because Kabbalistically a mountain is a symbol of love. He overwhelmed them with love to the point that they could not resist, right? God was so revealed, he was so close that there was no other option, right? So the Jews just committed and they said, now seven Ishmael. However, the Gemara says, the Talmud says that it was missing something. It was missing choice. And therefore that was rectified in the story of Purim, the Talmud tells us. In the story of Purim, God was completely hidden, completely. The miracle was a natural miracle. And it says in the Megillah that after the story of Purim happened, the Jews recommitted to the Torah. And therefore the Kabbalists explain that was the completion. So I think when you impart values to children, there's nothing wrong if they absorb those values and they live by those values. However, you need to educate them in such a way, and I think I'd like to think that my parents did that, in such a way that later on you internalize it and it becomes, and maybe part of that internalization means ups and downs, and you battle with it a little bit or you confront it a little bit, but you then make the choice later on, so that at the end of the day you're doing it because it's you, not because you were not because you couldn't resist it.
Just before we go on, maybe you could bring just one or two examples of your parents' commitment and how that affected you.
So I'll just tell you two little quick stories that come to mind. It's personal stories, but it's just things that have a tremendous impact on me. And I think it's a good lesson in terms of, you know, living values. One of the things that my father always taught us on Shabbat. In fact, it's one of the laws of Shabbat, but you know, it's one of the more difficult laws to keep. Is that Shabbat is not only supposed to be observed, you're not only even supposed to speak about things of Shabbat on Shabbat that are weekday, right? So in other words, not only you're not supposed to go into a car, but you're not even supposed to speak about going in a car, right? Unless it's for a mitzvah and so on and so forth. And that, and he was lived this without any compromise. He was like, we never spoke on Shabbat things that you had to do with weekday stuff, right? And I remember once my father was in jewelry, and he was a wholesale jeweler. He's mainly cultured pearls, and he one time there was a parcel that was coming from Japan, I think, a very very expensive parcel, and it went missing. The post office didn't know where it was, and I mean, it's not like today we have tracking on computers. It was different and went missing, and he was distressed. And I think it was a Friday, from memory. And he was talking about it, and you know, it was obvious that it was a problem. Shabbat came, and the thing didn't exist. Completely didn't exist until after Shabbat. Anyway, it was found, and everything was okay. But it was quite amazing. Can I have time for another quick story?
Yeah.
So this is an interesting thing. So we are taught that every Rosh Hashanah, one is supposed to. And this is true, and by the way, when I talk about these things, I want to make it very clear, as I often do. I was fortunate to grow up in such a home, and some people choose Yiddishkeit or choose some level of observance later on in life, and that has its advantages, by the way. That's even more real. It's really something that are known. And some people are on a journey and don't observe all the stuff that we observe, and that's fine because everyone is on their journey. And one should never be judged. But you asked me about my personal journey. So
the idea is the commitment, not necessarily where you're holding. The idea is one of your own levels.
So we're in a time of the year now, as we know, where we're supposed to grow. We're supposed to reflect. And when it comes Rosh Hashanah, we're actually supposed to take a step forward. So there's an old tradition, and this is applicable to everyone, no matter how non-observant or how extremely observant you are. And when it comes Rosh Hashanah, you're supposed to take on something for the next year, whether it's a something you weren't so careful about, or something you want to do is more than another mitzvah, whatever the case is. Anyway, so one Rosh Hashanah, my father was in business, and obviously, as I say, Shabbat, Yom Tov was as strict as ever. But then came Chol HaMoed. Chol HaMoed, for those who are not familiar, are the intermediary days. Like the intermediary days between the first days of Sukkot and the second days of Sukkot and some of the Pesach, right? The intermediary days for the first days of Pesach and the last days of Pesach. Now, there's some restrictions about what you can and can't do in those days, but essentially they are weekdays. And in terms of business, it's a gray area. You're sort of officially not supposed to work during those days, meaning you're not supposed to go to business, you go to a car and all that, but if you need to and you're going to lose a lot of money, then you can. So initially, when he started his business, he did work on Chol HaMoed, as many, many, many people do, many observant people do. And then it grew a little bit, and he came to the conclusion that one year decided, no, his resolution for Rosh Hashanah is, he let now all his customers, all his jewelers, all the retailers, he sent out a letter that he's no longer working on Chol HaMoed. So what do you think happened the first time that he did it, the first Chol HaMoed? In the middle, it was Erev Shmini Atzeret, last day of Chol HaMoed, or the night before the last day of Chol HaMoed. He gets a call from one of his customers, one of the retailers, very urgent call. He tracked him down at home. I know you closed, and I got the letter that you closed, but I've got someone that needs a special piece of jewelry very, very, very urgently. It was a lot of money. Do you have it? Can you give it to me? Can we do a deal? So on the phone, my father starts to think about it, and he thinks to himself, well, you know, Shulchan Aruch, the code of Jewish law says, if you can lose a lot of money, maybe you can. And he tells the guy, let me think about it. Puts down the phone, and he started to think about it, and maybe he could find a loophole, even though he made that commitment. And then he thinks to himself, hold on a second. Everything happens by divine providence. Why do you think this happened now? Why do you think this happened now? It never happened to me before. All of a sudden, the guy in the middle of the week tracks me down at home. It happened now because I made that commitment. So God is obviously testing me. He calls back the guy and says, nothing doing. He can call him in 3 days' time after Simchat Torah is over. So, and the guy was really upset, and he knew he might lose a customer over this, but he figured this is why it's happening. God is testing him because he made that commitment. He's standing with it. That's it. The guy was really upset. He said, I'm going to have to think. Okay, what can we do? So he put down the phone. He was relieved. He passed the test, and that was it. The minute after Simchat Torah ends, he comes home from shul, the phone goes, the guy says, do you still have it? I can do the deal if you give it to me tomorrow morning first thing. So it was. I remember that story. It was very beautiful.
Yeah, it's powerful. I mean, yeah, I remember your father very, very well. I have a son named after him. And he definitely was an example of someone who Judaism wasn't just something he did. It was something he lived, and it was a real reality. That's definitely true. Okay, so let's move on to a different point here. So you grew up religious. You are religious today. How would you define yourself today? Within religious Jews, there are many different branches and streams and stripes and sort of different ways of living. How would you define yourself, number one? And why are you that way? So obviously, you were brought up a certain way. But as you discussed, there comes a certain point in life, and I think everyone goes through this. Anyone who's brought up religious, who's a thinking person, goes through a certain point in their life where they make their own decision. In other words, they sort of, as you said, internalize it, they make it theirs. So who are you, what are you, and why are you that way? In other words, you obviously define yourself a certain way. Besides for the fact that you were brought up that way, why are you that way? What compels you? Are you convinced that only your way is the true way and everyone else has gotten it wrong? Or if everyone else has not gotten it wrong, so why aren't you like everybody else? You know, just for example, right? I imagine the answer is going to be that you're a Chabad Chassid, you're a ultra Orthodox Jew, but there are many other different streams in Judaism. There's the Belzer Chassidim also. There's people who come from Lithuania, the people who are, you know, and all good, committed, good Jews. But why aren't you like them? Right? Why have you chosen this path in life? Do you think that they're wrong and you're right, or how do you look at this?
Oh, it's a loaded question. I hope everyone's having fun watching this. Maybe you can participate a little bit.
That's right. If anyone has any questions to add,
the chat box here is empty. Help me out a little bit, Chevra. Come on. Okay, so wow, So ever since, and this is not a new phenomenon, by the way, ever since Jacob, I think, the beginning of the Jewish people, even before the Jewish people were redeemed from Egypt, there was always different types of people. So there were 12, so we have this thing, I mean, Hasidut and Kabbalah talks about this, right? There were 12 tribes. Each tribe was different. They were, came from Yaakov. So the Talmud says, "En karin la'avot ela lishlasha." You can only call three people fathers and four people mothers. Right? So that's Abraham, Yitzchak, Yaakov is the fathers. Sarah, Rivka, Rachel, and Leah are the mothers. Beyond that, there are 12 tribes. Yaakov branches into 12 tribes. The Jews come to Egypt. They live in 12 tribes. They are redeemed as 12 tribes. They traveled in the desert as 12 different tribes. They went into Israel as 12 different tribes. And then from then on, in different forms, different ways, it always was that way, right? Because unlike what some people think, actually Judaism, it goes back to the menorah concept, even within a family, it like extends to the broader family, the family of the Jewish people. Mm. So unlike what people think, actually, although there's so many laws in terms of Jewish observance, there's so many principles, there's so many things that we believe in, right? There is different ways. There's a tremendous room for different forms of expression within the same philosophies. Let me explain. Right? The Rambam, Maimonides laid down in a very, very succinct and clear way the 13 principles of faith, right? What we call the Yud Gimel Ikre Emunah, the 13 fundamentals of faith. Those of you who go to Shul Friday night, well, or used to go to Shul Friday night before COVID, or well, please God, go again to Friday night. Well, no, there's a song called Yigdal that many, many Shul sing. The Yigdal Elokim Chai actually has 13 stanzas, and it corresponds to the 13 principles of faith. First one being an existence of God, followed at the end by the belief in the Mashiach and in Tchis HaMesim. One of those 13 principles of faith, of course, a very, very fundamental one, is the eighth one, which really is the source of many others, which is the belief in Torah from Sinai. So that Torah that was given at Sinai, the Jewish people said at Sinai, there was a divine revelation. God gave us the Torah, which is eternal, a Torah that will never change, the written Torah, the oral Torah, and the concept of prophecy, the concept of praying only to one God, and so on and so forth. Right. Those principles, however, are kept a bit differently. In other words, they all result in the same 613 mitzvot, the same basic laws and so on and so forth. And they, however, there's different. There's Hasidim and there's non-Hasidim. And like you say, there's Sephardim and there's Ashkenazim. And there are different laws and different philosophies and different ways of looking at things, different areas of emphasis, different areas of pursuit, and so on and so forth, right? I'll tell you a quick little story. When I first started Bina, or in those days it was a different name, but I used to call myself a Sephardi in training, right? I was a rabbi, a part-time rabbi, in a small Sephardi synagogue around the corner from us called Bet Yosef. I absolutely loved it. They were completely different to me, different culture, different customs. I absolutely loved it because I love learning other customs and other ways of doing things. And I learned about Sephardim things I never knew before, and it was a beautiful experience, one I still cherish till today. So, but I noticed an amazing thing. The Sephardim talk differently to Ashkenazim. Their prayers are so different. Their customs are different, their liturgy is different, their culture is different, their tunes are different, everything is different, right? I mean, just give, for example, now in the month of Elul, the Sephardim get up now every morning really early to say Slichot. Us lazy Ashkenazim wait till the week before Rosh Hashanah, right? But so everything is different. So, but I noticed an amazing thing that I put into a historic context, and I gave rise to the eternity of Torah. It's a long-winded way of asking a question, but I'm going to get to it, right? So I noticed an amazing thing that despite the very obvious differences, and despite the fact that we went through centuries before WhatsApp and faxes and emails and communication, we went through centuries where Sephardim lived in one part of the world and Ashkenazim in a different part of the world, and there was almost no communication. The fundamental observances and the skin and bones of Jewish observance actually identical. And in fact, I was more surprised by the sameness than I was by the difference, right? Now, I want to take that principle and transfer it to your question. Now, first of all, I want to just, before I go further, it needs to make something very, very clear. You're asking in terms more of philosophies. You're not asking about the definition of who's Jewish. That's correct. A separate thing, right? Correct. A Jew is a Jew is a Jew. A person who's a Jew, meaning a person who has a Jewish mother or converted halachically, has a Jewish soul, and is as Jewish as me, as Jewish as you, even if they don't keep anything, right? So there's never a rejection of anyone that is Jewish. I mean, never rejection of any human being, but I'm saying in terms of Jewishness, all Jews are the same. If they're Jew, they're a Jew, right? Now, having said that, in terms of philosophy, the fact that there are different philosophies within Judaism, there are Hasidim and non-Hasidim and so on and so forth, that's in a way part of the beauty of Judaism. It's the different branches, the different tribes. And you asked me about who am I? So yes, of course, I grew up in a Chabad home. I'm part of the Chabad. In fact, I had a very interesting experience. My upbringing and my experience is not a typical Chabad upbringing, because I didn't go to Chabad school. There wasn't a big Chabad community when I grew up in South Africa. In fact, it was a very strong, what you call Lithuanian community. I went to a very strong, very ultra-Orthodox, but very non-Hasidic schools. My teachers and my friends were all non-Hasidim, came from the Lithuanian background, very, very strong followers of the Mussar movement and so on and so forth, right? Which I had a beautiful, beautiful education and some amazing, amazing teachers. We're all very respectful, and actually I think in a way I had a richer experience because of that, because actually I think I'm able to relate to many, many other people. But my home was very strongly Chabad, and that's what I observed. I visited the Lubavitcher Rebbe, my Zayder, Rabbi Elo, took me to visit the Lubavitcher Rebbe when I was 13. I had a private audience with him. He asked me to start learning Hasidus, which I did. And I've grown into that. And I went afterwards learning the Lubavitcher Shivas, and I was by the Rebbe for many years, and it's who I am. But I always think that who I am does not mean who you, to become a strong you, you don't need to make someone else weak, right? And that's, I've learned that very, very strongly. So if you ask me why, yes, I believe my hashkafa, my outlook, my education, my teaching is very much, very, very much influenced and guided by my Chabad upbringing, by the teachings of Hasidus, by the esoteric part of Torah. But if you looked at my library, you'll know that it's very broad, and I nash from lots of different places. And I certainly do not disrespect any philosophy within the 13 principles of faith. I mean, those parts of Yiddishkeit that have deviated from the belief in Sinai or the belief in the eternity of Torah, I don't reject the people, but I do reject the philosophy. It is not, in my view, the values that I subscribe to. But as long as a philosophy in Yiddishkeit, it could be Lithuanian, it could be Hasidic, non-Hasidic, Sephardi, Ashkenazi, modern Orthodox, strictly Orthodox, ultra-Orthodox, they all have a very, very important place, important role. They all, and we should all respect each other. We should all grow from each other. We should all learn from each other. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't have an identity. In fact, I think sometimes when people don't have an identity, they're all mixed up.
For a second, can you just touch on that a little bit? So without obviously disrespecting anyone else, can you just touch on, and there are people who have asked questions, and I'll get to that in a moment. Can you just touch on what, besides the fact that you were brought up that way, what specifically has the sort of the Lubavitch Chabad philosophy influenced you? How does that define you? If you can touch on that. So you just said without putting down anybody else, obviously, and everyone's needed and everyone's vital to the Jewish family, but what particularly pulls you, besides the fact that you were brought up that way, what particularly pulls you to the Chabad ideology, to the ultra-Orthodox and Chabad ideology? Yeah. Yes.
So, I mean, I think it's whole, well, specifically in Chabad philosophy, and again, this is not meant to, this is not a program to influence other people necessarily. It's just answer your question and express my experience, if it's interesting, right? So I've learned a lot of Hasidut, which is sort of based on Kabbalah and so on and so forth. A couple of things draw me to it. I mean, it's amazing depth and understanding of mitzvot at a very, very deep level, understanding of God, understanding of the relationship between God and the world and Torah, understanding of the depth of what a Jew is, And what that does, I mean, it's really a discussion for a number of hours, this, but what it actually does and what is it done for me is an interesting thing. And especially learning the Rebbe's talks, you see this come through a lot, where on the one hand, it actually encourages two opposite things, although they're not really opposite. It encourages an extremely strict adherence to halacha, and to Jewish observance and to service of God. It encourages an extremely God-centered life, because you see the depth of what the world is supposed to be. It's about what the mission of serving God is supposed to be, and it's about the reality of God, that it's really the only true and worthwhile reality in terms of being connected to God. But because it does that on all levels. And also, one of the things it does is also, it also talks a lot about the Jewish soul and the depth of what a Jew is. And it's the very same philosophy that actually breeds and encourages the philosophy of outreach, and never to judge anyone, and to see the depth of every Jew. And if a Jew doesn't keep anything, even a Jew doesn't, I'll tell you a beautiful story. Like, and I'll tell you, right? When we in Bellevue Hill, remember, we had the shtibel. So there was a guy who davened there, and he came to me, and he was all like surprised. He says, he came to me, and he said to me, "There's, you know, we have a Jewish neighbor. There's a guy who lives in the apartment building next door to the shtibel. And he's, I try to tell him to come to shul. He says, no, he doesn't go to shul. He's very distant. And he does nothing, absolutely nothing. And I said to him, so it was just before, it was before Rosh Hashanah. And I said to the, he tells me, I said to the guy, why don't you at least come Yom Kippur? He says, no, I don't go to shul Yom Kippur. But what I do is every Yom Kippur, I take a walk in a nature park. I have a nature walk. So I looked at this fellow, the congregant of ours. He doesn't live anymore. He lives somewhere else now. I said to him, do you understand how amazing that is? Do you understand that, like, you see the power of the soul, that a Jew knows Yom Kippur is different? He doesn't know enough. He's not conscious enough to know that you should daven in shul or keep Yom Kippur or fast, whatever the case is. But Yom Kippur touches every Jew. And therefore, he comes Yom Kippur and he takes a nature walk. I'm not sure what spiritual he got on nature walk, but it's different. It's a different day, right? That perspective comes from the same, for me at least, comes from the same source as driving everyone crazy to take on a new mitzvah and to grow in their spirituality and to encourage people to keep mitzvot, because it's the same thing. It's about the depth of godliness, the depth of mitzvah, the depth of Torah, and the depth of a Jew, and understanding each person on their journey and just encouraging them to grow where they are, to take the next step, but not to think that I'm superior or think that I'm better, or God forbid, or because who knows who's better? We don't know, right? Maybe the one nature walk he took Yom Kippur is more, I don't know, right? Obviously, my job is to encourage mitzvot, but you never know in the eyes of God what person's challenges are, what person's tests are, and who knows? So, yeah, so that's the sort of a similar thing. But I wanted to go back to what you were saying before, because I think it's really, really important. It's important to understand that every group within Orthodox Judaism, let's put it that way, right, has a role to play. And what pains me, and it's not because I have a weak identity, on the contrary, I believe I have a very strong identity. I'm very strong in Chabad. However, what pains me is the disrespect between groups, the polarization between groups, right? Where those who are less ultra-Orthodox talk about the Haredim, and the Haredim talk about the modern, and this and the other. And it's ridiculous, because everyone has a big role to play. To play. They all believe in the same God. They're keeping basically the same mitzvot. Yes, we might agree or disagree on lots of things, might have philosophical debates, but essentially the base of the menorah is the same, with all these different outlooks and philosophies, and we all have a contribution to make, and each one has a very unique contribution. That's really, really important to understand. And the Jewish people are all richer. Because of all these different philosophies, because they all come from the same candelabra.
Yeah, that's beautiful. I must say, just on a sort of a more personal note, I remember very well being a Bet Yosef as a small child in the Sfardi Shul. That was an incredible experience. I still remember the Sfardi Akafot, totally different than what we do on Simchas Torah. But it is very important to recognize the beauty in other sort of in other paths and other ways. And I think it just, I'm not sure if this is a commercial or not a commercial, but I think actually Abina, we actually, someone actually sent me a song recently by a Jewish singer, which basically the idea of the song was that, like, every group sort of emphasizes one idea, and really all these ideas just means to be a Jew. In other words, you put all the ideas together, it just, that basically comprises a Jew. And he sort of implied that should be like the anthem of Bina, because Bina is, even within the, it's a very diverse place in many ways, but even within the sort of observant people that attend Bina, it is an incredibly diverse sort of attendance. We have people from every, and I think in general, Sydney, I've said this to a lot of people. One of the beauties of Sydney is that, you know, every place has problems, obviously, and thank God we have plenty of problems also, and plenty of disputes and plenty of arguments because we're Jewish. But I think relative to other places, we're actually less polarized. I think that even on a personal note, the types of friends that I have here, I probably would have never had anywhere else simply because I never would have met them. You know, in most places, if you're part of a Hasidic shul, that's your shul, and you never meet someone who's not Hasidic. And it's just the way it is. But in Sydney, it's not like that. We're such a small community. I think because of that, we're very exposed to everyone else. And I think that's actually a beautiful thing. I think it's very, would you agree to that? Would you?
Yeah, no, I agree with you 100%. That's why I'm hoping for Mashiach to come very soon, but until it happens, I'm sticking around here. I love it.
That's right. All right, someone asked a question here.
There's a question on the chat. Do you want to deal with it now?
Yeah, I want to ask the question because I actually wanted to ask a similar question, so I'll put that into the question. So, understand your upbringing, where you are, why you are, where you are, etc. But obviously, everyone has challenges, and everyone has spiritual challenges. I don't believe that you're an exception, as highly as I regard you, and I do regard you very highly. I don't believe you're a perfect tzaddik. Maybe you are, I don't know, but I don't believe so. And therefore, everyone has spiritual challenges, and everyone has things they need to overcome in life. So maybe you can touch on that. What were some of your challenges, spiritually speaking? Did you struggle in any specific area of Judaism? Did you ever struggle with your faith in general? Did you ever struggle with a particular mitzvah? As someone asked over here in the questions, can you describe the challenges you had to overcome and how you overcame them when you went to university in Australia? I remember when you studied, I was very young at the time, and you got a master's in education. That's a particular time in your life. Maybe you can touch on that as well. But just in general, what are the challenges that you've overcome spiritually or that you're trying to overcome still?
So, let me just, first of all, agree with you. I'm very, very far from perfect Zadik. Very far, extremely far. I'm a human being like everyone else. We all have challenges. That's part of the process, because part of Yiddishkeit's teachings, and particularly in the teachings of Tanya and so on, is that most of us are born to struggle. I don't mean struggle physically. I mean hopefully not. To struggle internally. We're all given challenges. I'm not going to go through specifically what the challenges are. That's a little bit too personal. But we all have. We all have some challenges, meaning challenges either in personality flaws, which you have to work on, challenges, spiritual challenges, might be in prayer, might be in learning. And yes, in faith, everyone has challenges at some point in time, where it might be, I mean, as I said to you before, thank God, within the area of faith, I had actually a very, very strong grounding, and I'm very appreciative of that, and was very, very ingrained in me and very, you know, in a very big way. But questions do come up, and I think any normal person would have questions. Any person has times in their life where they're weak. Now, I think also part of this process is that it's important for us to realize that we have an inner struggle. Every person has an inner struggle because we're born with two souls. As the Tanya teaches us, we're born with an animal soul and a godly soul. And we're never supposed to trust ourselves. We're always supposed to make sure that we surround ourselves with good people. First of all, we surround ourselves with mentors. We're supposed to have mentors, as we know, and that's something we all have to have. I have a mentor. I believe you have a mentor. Everyone has a mentor. And check in, we have to have friends. And then we have to also identify the areas of weakness. Now, I'll just digress for a second and relate to that question. I'm not sure exactly what the question meant exactly, but I'll just try and answer as best I can. So I didn't go to university after school. I went to yeshiva and I studied all my years in yeshiva. That's why I encourage my own children to do as well. That's the pathway that we take in the belief that we need a very, very big, good grounding. By the way, yeshiva is no less rigorous than university. In fact, probably more rigorous intellectually. And it's very, very demanding if you do it properly, of course. I mean, if you don't do it properly, then you don't do anything properly. But I mean, if you learn in yeshiva properly, it's a very, very deeply academic process. So it's not like people who go to yeshiva as opposed to university are not engaged in academics. But, and there's a lot of life skills you learn there as well, which prepare a person, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So I didn't, but later on when I started to teach and I was involved in education, I did enroll in university and had an interesting experience. And I'm going to share, because you wanted to be personal, I'm going to share with you an interesting experience. I don't know if I've ever shared this publicly, but I will. So it was over 2 years. The first year, because one of the issues, I mean, people, you know, might be thinking, why my children never went to university, or why Well, I didn't go to university, and it's two reasons. First of all, it's part of the first formative years being very steeped and focused on having a Torah background. And second of all, also sometimes the environment and the culture on college campuses, university campuses are not the best. So I had an interesting experience. The first year I went, it was a course. It was an after-school course. It was for postgraduate people. That's what it was designed for. It was designed, and it was in the evening, and it was in South Sydney, I think it was. University of New South Wales, but it was one of the far campuses. You know me in geography. I don't know where I went. Anyway, it was a faraway place, and it was
definitely didn't drive yourself there.
I didn't drive there. I either took a train or someone drove me. as you know, yeah. Otherwise, I probably wouldn't be here tonight. Probably still be lost. But it was a very mature thing. People came there twice a week, whatever it was. All people. These were principals, parents, business people. They were all people who were not there for the culture, not there. They were there to just have the lesson, the lecture, and went on. So it was just very interesting, and I went on. The second year, I transferred, and actually, because after the first year, I realized I'm halfway through a master's, so I decided to continue, and I enrolled in Sydney Uni, and there it actually meant going to certain courses during the day, and it was actually the first time I was in actually a real college campus situation, to be honest, and I came there, and it was actually it was a very non-spiritual environment. And at that time, I actually wasn't even doing what I'm doing now. At that time, I was a principal of a school, and it was a religious school, it was yeshiva, and I was very much surrounded, insulated, really, right? And it was a very non-spiritual environment, and I thought about it. And I discussed with other people, and I thought about it. And what I did was, I'm not going to tell you what, but I actually took on, just as a reminder, I took on a special astringency in halacha, which means something I wasn't keeping before, not because I had to keep it, but it was something you didn't need to. It was an extra optional kind of thing. And I took it on just because I was now in a sort of a non-spiritual environment, and I decided I need to do something as a reminder for myself and to fortify myself spiritually. Because I think no matter who you are, you always have to be on guard. I think in life in general, we can always slip back. People work on themselves and then slip back. In whatever it is, it might be in personality issues, might be in personal growth, might be in spiritual growth, whatever.
The K.A.V.O. tells that the ethics of our father says, Al tamin ba'atzmucha ad yoyim moysach, that you shouldn't believe in yourself till... Till
your last day, exactly. So yeah, I was always, you know, always made sure that I didn't take away from my regular schedule of Torah learning and so on and so forth. Even though I went there for a specific purpose, I didn't go just to be there. I went there to be able to teach better and to learn better and so on. So it was a great experience, and it stood me in great stead. But it was an aspect of it, and I did think about it and do something about it.
Fascinating. Someone asked the question here. It's not necessarily relevant specifically to our discussion, but it's an interesting question. I'll ask it because someone asked it. Do you think there are any modern day prophets?
No, so the Talmud tells us that prophecy ended before the Second Temple. There are modern day great people, there are great teachers, great rabbis, great spiritual people. But prophecy, the way we believe in prophecy in terms of what the Torah says, ended before the Second Temple.
All right. So just another interesting question I was thinking about today. There's the religious part of life, and then there's the regular part of life, right? Family life, marriage, children. How do you feel your religious life has influenced the other parts of your life? Has it benefited you? Has it made you have a better life, a happier life? Or is it just... sort of something separate?
Sure.
Do you think your marriage is better because you're an observant Jew, or you would have had the same marriage without it? Or do you think that you educated your children better, at least most of them, because you're an observant Jew? Or would you have done the same job regardless? Let's put it that way.
Okay, so that's a very, very fascinating question. So I think there are many people that bring up beautiful children who aren't observant people, or don't keep much Yiddishkeit also, and they still have wonderful, wonderful, wonderful children and wonderful marriages. However, I think let's do it the other way around, right? I certainly don't think that they're two worlds. I think they're one and the same world. For me, and I think as part of the belief system that we have, the Torah is not a set of rules. As I'm very passionate about personal growth, and I give lots of shiurim and personal growth and so on and so forth. And one of the reasons I do that is because I believe that that's a very, very often missed part in Torah. Now, it does not mean, so both things are true, by the way. It does not mean that if you don't keep the mitzvot of the Torah, that your relationships are not as good, or your parents, or your parenting is not as good. It also doesn't mean that if you do keep the mitzvot of the Torah, that you necessarily have good relationships. There are many, many people who have shocking personalities and keep mitzvot, right? Now, I was going to say they're religious people. They're probably, I don't know if that's religious. It depends how you define religious. But so we know that the Torah has two parts to it, between man and man, between man and God. They're both parts of the same Torah, and the Torah is all-encompassing. The concept of Torah is how to live your life as a God-centered Jew. Life means every part of your life. So for me, it's an unquestionable thing that Torah learning has improved. Now, you have to be conscious of it. I think you have to be conscious that what you learn shouldn't be an academic subject, right? In fact, the word Torah does not mean study. It doesn't mean academia. The word Torah means hora'ah, a lesson of how to live, right? It's a manual for life. And I think, I feel and I believe strongly that keeping the Torah, if that's your goal, means that you're going to apply Torah in every single part of your life, whether it's your marriage, whether it's your relationships, whether it's your parenting. That doesn't mean that there's the on strategies and good tools to be learned in other, I mean, I quote a lot of secular books and secular literature and modern psychology and so on and so forth. But it does mean that there's principles, that there are principles that Torah espouses that are fundamental in parenting, fundamental in relationships. I mean, to give you one example, right? I think a lot of the reason why there's such a breakdown in some relationships nowadays is because there's a lot of egocentricity today. It's a very me world. People are very into doing things that work for them. People are very slow today to give up a little bit, right? And there's a whole movement, like it's got to fit for me and I have to feel comfortable with it and I've got to take care of myself all the time and so on and so forth. Now, self-preservation is an important thing, but we know that one of the fundamentals of Judaism is humility and bittul. We call it bittul in the Hasidic terminology. Bittul means that don't take yourself so seriously. Humility, make room for other people, make room for God, make room for other people. It's one of the same thing. In other words, to be always like this. So let me put it a different way. It depends how you observe Yiddishkeit, right? If you observe mitzvot, like you put on tefillin or you light Shabbos candles, because that's what, it's always a good thing to do. But if you do it just by rote, because that's what you're taught to do, always a relationship with God. It's because you're making room in your life for something higher. In other words, if you live your life subservient or making room for others with humility, then making room for God and making room for other people and making room for other views, all is one part of one package. That's why, in fact, our rabbis tell us that derech eretz kodma la'Torah, that if you actually don't have proper human relationships, you will not have a proper relationship with God. You might keep a mitzvah too, but you want to have a deep relationship with God. So, you know, for me, the way I understand, especially the way I was brought up, and I think the way we try to bring our children up is that it's one God, one Torah, one life. The philosophy is that every part of your lifestyle is governed by values which come from our moral compass, which is Torah from Sinai, the eternal values, the eternal ideas, the eternal principles that govern every part of our life. So yes, in short, the answer is absolutely. I don't know how it works for other people, but for me, there's no question that all aspects of our lives are enriched through Torah principles.
Okay. If anyone has any questions, now would be the time to please post it, comment. I'll just end off with one more question, and if anyone has any questions, we'll ask it afterwards. So you're obviously an Orthodox Jew, a Chassid, etc. But why your profession? Why did you choose to take this specific path in life? And is this the path that you wanted for all your children? You know, if I would have become an accountant, let's say, would you have been happy with that? In other words, do you look at this as everyone needs to be a rabbi or everyone needs to be sort of a Jewish community leader? Is this the ultimate? Why did you specifically choose this path in life?
Okay, so as you know, so that's a brilliant question. So all parts of the question is very good. So the answer to the question is as follows. First of all, as you know, I grew up as a Chabad Chassid. I went to yeshiva in the in the 80s. I was in New York in I came to Australia in 88. So it means I was learned in yeshiva in the early 80s, and I got married around 87, 86, and so on. Sorry. Those were the years specifically. It started long before that. Those were the years that I would stand at gatherings every Shabbos where the Rebbe would talk, particularly in 1986, 87, where the Rebbe would talk about the importance of going out and inspiring other people and helping other people. That was the foundation of the whole Shlichut program, where the Rebbe wanted his followers, his Hasidim, to become leaders and bring Yiddishkeit to other people, bring Judaism to other people with love, with inspiration, with acceptance, with the respect for the fundamental worth and value which is in every Jewish soul. And that's why I wanted people to go to the far-flung corners of the earth and do it. So it was my father was a businessman, although he had a lot of influence, a lot of people in a different way. And he subscribed to the same value, but he did it as a businessman, right? So for me, my aspiration as soon as I got married was always to go out somewhere and help others. And that's why I landed up in Australia. I mean, I had a connection to Australia before because as a student, I studied in Melbourne a little bit. Also as part of the student exchange Shlichut program that Chabad has. But that's, you know, then I got offered something in Sydney and I came in. I always wanted to do that. I love what I'm doing in terms of, and I think it's a fundamental principle. Now, does everyone have to do it in this particular way? Absolutely not. I do think every Jew has to, you know, the previous Lubavitcher Rebbe used to say that anyone who knows an Aleph, even if he doesn't know the Bet, he has to go and teach someone who doesn't even know an Aleph, right? Because we're all responsible for each other, and the expansion and the preservation of Yiddishkeit comes if we inspire each other, no matter who you are. So I think everyone has to have that responsibility. Obviously, to turn it into a career, that was my aspiration. That's what I heard. I was instilled in. However, not everyone can do that. Not everyone can do it for practical reasons. Not always there's a place to go. Not always there's an availability. And not always, and we need all kinds of people, all kinds of things, right? So if you ask me my question, if you would become an accountant, first, I don't think you make a very good accountant. That's the only problem. that's genetic, by the way. But on a serious note, if you would become a businessman or an accountant and would still subscribe to the same values, where you would still learn and observe mitzvot and give a shiur on the side and inspire the people, I'd be very, very happy. I would accept that. I'm very happy that you chose to come drive me crazy at dinner, but it would be the same thing. If one of my children, I've been often asked the question, would I be upset if one of my children left the path of Yiddishkeit altogether? Right? That's, I think, probably a hard question. The answer is, I have to be honest. Yes. Would I be upset? Yes. But what I would do is, I would have to work with myself to accept it nonetheless and to love them unconditionally as I counsel other people to do. But that's a different journey, a different thing. But in terms of, again, it goes back to the menorah. If anyone, and I mean, even now, I mean, you happen to be working in Sydney and you're working in a particular context inspiring others. You have a brother that lives in Pomona, in a publishing, doing publishing works of Hasidut, very different career, very different context, same values. And that's great. Let me ask you a question if we're asking questions already.
Oh,
I didn't see this coming. So do you feel forced? How do you feel about how you were brought up?
Whew. How long do we have? We have 2 minutes left there.
Well,
I think to be honest, you know, if for the rest of the 2 minutes that we have, I think a lot of what you described, sometimes a little bit different, but in the general sort of in the general sense, the home which we were brought up in was extremely similar. It was very inspiring, very uplifting, very happy, very loving. You know, you were definitely, I would say, a strict parent, which I don't think is a bad thing. Definitely had to keep the rules. You know, following the rules was definitely a thing. Every rule, by the way, not only, it's in fact, actually probably more other rules, like going to bed on time, sort of, you know, just the idea of following rules, I think for children is always important. But I think whatever you were brought up with, you definitely reflected onto us and to the wider community in general. So this was a very enjoyable evening for me. I hope everyone else enjoyed it as well. Thank you all for joining, and we'll be back here next week for another episode of the Shmooze.
Okay, stay tuned. Thank you, everyone, and have a great night.
Thank you, everyone.